Okay, good enough.
Oops, this is very loud.
Too loud?
Okay, I usually... Okay, if I start shouting, stop me. This is not going to work out nicely. Because I can see that the volume is too high. Okay, we'll see how it works out. I'll try, because I can, okay, if I go further away then, well, we'll see. Anyway, good afternoon, welcome to week 4, which is in fact lecture 3. This is the first lecture where you're going to get some hardcore linguistics. Okay. I'm going to throw quite a lot of terminology at you. I will also be fairly close to the reading for today. This is also going to be the case for next week. The two lectures today and next week are very closely related in the sense that they belong to the same area of linguistic bless you, this is a tradition, right? Can someone please do this every time now so that we get used to it? Bless you. So phonetics and phonology basically belong together. Okay, lots of people still arriving. Shall I wait for a minute? Okay. Right, let's start for good. Before I talk to you about phonetics and a bit about phonology, I'd like to not revise what we did or repeat what we did in the last lecture, but I'd like to show you what the no list, this is sort of a non-English word, but I like to call it the no list, would look like or will look like for the different lectures that I'm going to put online. In the end, at the end of the whole semester, you're going to have a whole list of items that relate to how important certain concepts are. I hear a general hum. Can we... Okay, thank you. So, for example, on the no list, there are some aspects or some concepts that I mentioned last time that relate to human versus animal communication. Now you notice that they're all, or virtually all, in boldface. There's only one which isn't. This means these are the terms that I really expect you to know and to apply and to work with actively. You don't have to write this down, I'll upload it again on StudIP, of course. There will also be a separate list that I will keep adding to. So I will expect you to know what I mean, or what linguists mean, when we refer to displacement in the linguistic sense, or arbitrariness. Onomatopoeia is less important in the sense that this is not something which is going to be as central to, let's say, a final exam question or something like that. But it's still not in brackets, because there are also some aspects which, on that list, which I'm going to put within brackets. Now these are nice to know, nice to have, nice to understand topics that will perhaps make the difference between a 1 and a 2, or make the difference between really convincing me or just saying, yeah, passed. Quite nicely, in fact, but not top. So, for example, the difference between, or not the difference, the correspondence between spelling and pronunciation is something that I will not concentrate on in a final exam in any way that, if you don't know about it, you're going to have difficulties passing the exam. Okay. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't know it, because it's part of the lecture, but it's not something which I expect you to have as active in a knowledge of as the bold-faced ones. I'm trying to help you there in the sense of making it easier for you to distinguish between what's really important and what's important, but maybe not quite as important. Because I know I'm throwing a lot of information at you. And it's not, during the lecture, it's not always immediately obvious what is really relevant and what is perhaps less relevant. With this list, I'm trying to help you there. It doesn't... Yeah, okay. What is the difference between long and langage? Yes? Can someone help? We had long, parole, and langage last time. Can someone help? Do you remember the difference between long and parole? I hope you do. Anyone? No? I also introduced the concepts of performance versus competence. And I said that they are related to this concept. Competence is the abstract cognitive ability of knowing what language is and what our language is. Right? The fact that you are mostly native speakers of German means that you have a capacity, a cognitive capacity, which allows you to know what's okay in German and what's not okay in German. It's something abstract. It's something that you've acquired during language acquisition. We're not going to do anything on language acquisition in this semester. It's something that you learn or acquire as a child. What I'm currently producing is performance, in the sense of it is what I can do on the basis of my competence in English. So, performance is what you can actually see, what you can read, what you can hear. Competence is the much more abstract concept. And langue and parole are the two concepts introduced by de Saussure that basically relate to this. And then the whole system would be langage. Okay? Right. Just to give you an idea of an exam question, and I don't really like to mention the exam all that much because, yes, I know it's there, but I don't want to stress you out or scare you off. But just to give you an idea of what might be coming your way, in the exam at the end there will be several sections, two sections usually, where we have first, the first section will be a list of shorter questions, some definition questions, some questions where you have to apply what we heard about in the semester. And then there will be an essay question. We have to do an essay question because you will also be evaluated with respect to the language that you use. And we can only do this if we have a short essay from you. Really quite short, but still it should be sufficient to evaluate your language. And that was, in a previous exam, an exam question that I asked, evaluate the claim that human and animal communication are in fact very similar. And you would then have to say whether that's true or whether you think on the basis of what you heard in the lecture that can be confirmed or where there are differences. And I gave you some examples that suggested that this is, in fact, that the difference is maybe not so big. But then there were also some very clear differences, and it would be nice if, within this very short essay, you could get across the fact that you've understood these differences and similarities. Okay? Right, let's move on to phonetics and later on phonology. As I said, it's the first of two lectures that hang together. And I think you've already been exposed to some of the aspects, or some of the things that I'm going to show you today, namely the phonetic alphabet, the international phonetic alphabet, in the language classes, right? There, the emphasis is on being able to read it, if I understand things correctly. So when you go to a good dictionary that lists pronunciation in IPA, then you should make sense, or should be able to make sense of this. This lecture is much more about the system behind it, what lies behind, well, how we produce the sounds that we use in English. And then also how we, as linguists, have agreed on transcribing them. You yourself will not be required to produce longer transcriptions of texts. It's something good to know, but it's not going to be part of an exam at the end of, here I mentioned the exam again, exam at the end of the semester. But it's something that you will be confronted with again and again throughout your student career, so it doesn't hurt learning to actually do it actively. As I said, there will be lots of new terminology, but it will be terminology that's mentioned in the book. If you haven't read the chapter for today, then you can go and check there in more detail. I'm not just going to repeat everything that's in the book, but this one, as I said, is much closer to it than usual, than some others. Right, here is what... Okay, we need to agree on the fact that I do the talking and you do the listening. I hear a constant hum, and this has been a problem for the past 4 years that I've been doing the lecture, and if we don't agree on it at the beginning, it's not going to be nice with us. Okay? I said I'm recording this lecture. You can listen to the lecture at home. If you need to chat, you're welcome to chat, but not inside the room. Okay? Partly also, or mostly, not necessarily because of me, but because you are disturbing people who want to listen. So I'm going to get really annoyed if you continue. Whether that bothers you or not is a different question, but please, okay? You're not forced to sit here. Right. Okay, here's a quote to start you off with the topic. The most highly skilled muscular activity that human beings ever achieve. So it seems to be to do with coordination of various things that are happening inside our head, or in fact inside our mouth. Okay? And we need to look at this in more detail. Just before we do this, let's think about what is sound. In fact, sound is of course a form of energy that's sort of transmitted from one particle to the next, sort of one particle nudges the next one and then transfers waves, sound waves, which are in fact losing energy in the process of doing so, and whatever reaches our ears is in fact air particles that vibrate, okay, and that, or that sort of are pushed one by the next one. Okay. I've already mentioned waves, I think, in the sentence just now, at least I wanted to. We know the concept of sound waves, okay, and these waves are then picked up by our eardrum, and are transferred via a really quite interesting sort of biological setup. This is not the linguistic part of it, but if you want to read up more on this, this is quite fascinating how it works. And somehow, the human brain then interprets the vibrations that are transmitted and makes sense of them. And as you also did see in the reading, I hope, or as you can check in the reading, that what happens is, in fact, that depending on how these air particles vibrate, we perceive, or our brain perceives, these sounds differently. And as it says in the reading, and there is the bottle experiment, which Kevin Watson mentions, you know this. I mean, if we've got a big bottle and we blow over the top of it, then we get a deep sound, a low sound, and if we've got a milk bottle that's half filled, then we will get a different sound. So it seems to be related to certain physical properties that influence the type of sound that is made. And Kevin Watson also mentions the visit to the dentist, where of course you're asked to say ah and not e, for obvious reasons. So we can see the connection between the sound that's produced and the form or the configuration of elements in our mouth. In fact, the technical term that we use for this is the vocal tract. So the next few slides will be about explaining the names for the different parts of the human vocal tract. And I mentioned last time that, well, our human vocal tract is special. It's different from that of other animals or of animals. Kanzi does not have a vocal tract that allows him to speak in the same way as we do. So this is something that is really specific to humans. Right, here is a human head with a number of arrows pointing to important aspects inside. Important mostly or virtually only for producing sounds. There are other parts that could be mentioned, but I'm going to concentrate on those that are relevant for producing sounds in English. Well, this is trivial in a way. Lips, yes, we know where the lips are. When we move the lips together, then that's partly because of the lips, but it's also because of the movement of the jaw. If I put my jaw down, then my mouth opens. Yeah, okay. So, the lower lip moves upwards and downwards. This is trivial. And the upper lip is non-movable, yeah, it's just basically fixed. Therefore also the teeth, which again is trivial, are not movable. Well, the upper teeth, the lower one moves with the jaw. We only use the front teeth in speech production. Whether we have teeth at the back of our mouth or not, doesn't matter. Right, first technical term that you may not have come across before, the alveolar ridge. Now, if you take the tip of your tongue, I'll be asking you to do a few things, some of them more embarrassing than others. If you put the top of your tongue, or the tip of your tongue, at the front of your mouth, behind the top teeth, I can't show this to you, but I'm sure you understand what I mean, and then move the tongue backwards, then you reach a bump. And this bump is the alveolar ridge. And that's one of the places that will be relevant for the types of sounds that we produce in English. The next term that you're probably not familiar with is the hard palate. And if you, again, move your tongue, the tip of your tongue, sort of past the hard palate, past the alveolar ridge, then you reach this sort of slightly curved area in your mouth, which is hard, in the sense that there's a bone that stops you from putting your tongue inside your nose, I guess. Yeah? Yes. If you go further back, then it's much more soft, right? Don't go too far back. And this soft bit is actually the velum. So this is a patch of soft tissue. Some people make the distinction between hard palate and soft palate. The hard one being, the one that we discovered first, and the soft one, the one further behind, because, it is softer. And then we have the uvula, which in fact doesn't have all that much to do with English sounds. Well, we'll see. It's this sort of cone-shaped pendulum, as it says here on the slide, which Well, the uvula basically stops the food from going down the wrong way, right? No, well, going up, not down the wrong way, sorry, up the nose, sorry. Yes, yes. And then we have what's circled here, which we would really call the throat. But linguists like technical terms. They call that, or call this area, the pharynx. The velum, of course, also acts as some sort of valve, or whatever you want to call it, to make sure that air either goes through your nose or not. And that will become important as well when we look at different types of sounds that we make. Now, the throat, or the pharynx as we call it, is again split into two parts, into the so-called oral cavity and the nasal cavity. Well, sort of on the top it sort of splits up, let's put it like that. And we have the last thing here, which is the larynx. Okay, so we have pharynx and larynx. And this larynx is important particularly for not getting food down the wrong way as well. The front of this area of the larynx is different with male humans than there's a difference between women and men, and you probably have heard about the Adam's apple, which is a sort of protruding thing. Right, and then we have something which is really important, and this is sort of stylized here in sort of two semicircles or something like that, which are the vocal folds, Stimmbänder. Sometimes in English they're called vocal cords as well. And the area between them, which is either bigger or smaller, as we'll see, is called the glottis. Do we need to know this? Yes, you do. You need to know all those terms. Lips are easy, teeth are easy, the rest you need to learn. I'm assuming. And I just realized I think I mixed up something. Well, there's also the epiglottis, which is here, which is not the larynx is important about putting food down or not. No, it's the epiglottis. Sorry, I mixed up something. It's this little thing which stops people from swallowing food into the lungs, I guess, is probably not the best way of putting it, but you know what I mean. Right. The tongue can be further split up into the tip, the front, the center, and the back, and in fact also the root of the tongue. And some aspects of this will be important with respect to which elements are involved in producing sound. Now, virtually all of these elements that I introduced work together in producing different types of sound. And it's important that they're coordinated correctly, which is why, it's actually a fairly advanced thing. Is that all we need? No, obviously not. We need air. Remember the bottle experiment? Well, one part was the glass or the bottle of milk or the milk bottle, which was filled or not. That's one element. But then, of course, we need the air that produces the sound waves by moving over the opening of the bottle. In fact, what we need is pulmonic airstream. What does that mean? Well, it's basically air from our lungs. Okay. And in fact, it's egressive airstream, egressive pulmonic airstream. Egressive, it's, well, we're breathing out rather than in. There are some possible sounds that are made by breathing in, but they are not part of English sounds. So the stream then hits the larynx and the vocal cords and then leaves our mouth. And I'd like to look at that now with you in a bit more detail. Voicing is one important aspect of this. And this depends on the size of the glottis. Remember, the glottis is the size between the vocal cords. If it is open, then the air can just go through. And there is no vibration that is caused that would produce voicing. If there is vibration, well, no, if the space is smaller, then the vocal cords start to vibrate, and that's what then produces voicing. You can try this out, and that's where the embarrassing bit starts again. Can you put your hand to your throat and produce these three words and listen to what, not not listen, feel what happens while you say the first consonant? See, she, fee, right? Now obviously, E is voiced, you can actually feel something vibrating. Yeah? But when you say see, at the beginning nothing vibrates. So that's basically the difference between voicing and unvoiced sound production. You can try it with saying, ah, and of course it vibrates all the way through. Okay? Ah, yes. So that's a major distinction. That's going to be one of the important distinctions between different types of consonants, whether they are voiced or not, voiced or voiceless. All vowels are voiced. The next term I'd like to introduce is that of pitch, which has to do with the speed with which the vocal cords vibrate. And that depends on various aspects, mostly how big the larynx is. And as we know, men have lower voices, usually, not necessarily, but very often, and that's because their larynx is typically bigger than that of women. Now, another exercise that Kevin Watson suggests in his chapter is to hum a tune. I don't know whether we should now all start humming a tune, but hum a tune and whispering at the same time. Okay, go ahead. Hum and whisper at the same time. I'm not going to try because it's not really possible. You can whisper. You can't. No, you can't, right? Right. I'd like to show you two fascinating videos, and I'm going to play them for a while. These are videos that I think could not be produced anymore like that because they were X-ray videos. And have a look what happens during the production of words. Well, they're actually not nonsense words, but see what happens. And in particular, look at what happens to the jaw, look at what happens to the tongue, look what, whether the area between tongue and palate is bigger or smaller, etc. Let's have a look.
On top of his deck, 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 on top of his deck.
Okay. Did you see how the tongue, the back of the tongue, moved up and down? And of course also the jaw that moved up and down? Okay, here's the second one. Okay? So quite obviously, the position of the tongue seems to be one of the determinants in whether we say t or k. Yeah, makes sense. I mean, if you try it out yourself, then whether you say t or k basically depends on where you put your tongue. Right? And it's quite nice to see this here, I think. These videos, unfortunately, are no longer available online. The link, that was the original link. Peter Ladefoged is a famous phonetician, and he wrote a very well-known introductory textbook, A Course in Phonetics. If you're interested in that, or in the field, then this is one of the sources where you could go read more about it. Okay, so we had voicing and, well, whether a consonant is voiced or voiceless. The next two important aspects are place and manner. And we will be talking about place of articulation and manner of articulation. And that was really nicely shown in the video, I think. If you say hapa, hata, haka, then you can describe the place of where, for example, your tongue touches the palate, or which of the terms that I introduced are involved, and also the manner in which it is involved. And we'll look at that in much more detail. Okay. Add voicing to this, and then we've got a fairly complete description of consonants. So, for example, the difference between hpa, hta, and hka, and hba, and hda, and hga, is basically whether the consonants are voiced or not. And if you were to try it out, then you should really, with the second set, feel vibration throughout the production. And with this one, you should feel a short period where there is no vibration. And that's because the consonants are not voiced. Now, there is a question mark here, because, I mean, hva, we would probably agree on spelling it like that, hza, yeah, but there's, I mean, how do I produce the third one in, well, I don't know. It doesn't quite work. So, that's to make the point that the English spelling system cannot be used to represent all sounds, particularly, of course, not if other languages are involved. Yeah? So, spelling is not pronunciation, and the way we transcribe things is not necessarily phonetically the same as the way we would spell things. And that's where the IPA that you've already, I think, been exposed to comes in, because that's what we generally use to describe, or not to describe, to note down or to transcribe sounds. It's a system, as I said, of phonetic notation. It is similar to the letters that we use in the Latin alphabet. It's fairly old. It's been continually revised, but it hasn't been revised for the last 8 years. The most recent version is out, is from 2005. If you want to look at the International Phonetic Association and the IPA or more information about it, want to read more information about it, this is where you can go. Right, now what I'd like to do, and I'll do this a little bit more quickly, for the next 10 or 15 minutes or so, is to go through different consonants and then different vowels to describe place of articulation, manner of articulation, and whether they are voiced or voiceless. And I'd like to start with place of articulation. We can have a bilabial consonant. And I think it makes sense. Well, you can easily find out what this is. It's either B or P, because in both cases, both lips are involved. So, for example, pop has it's twice P, which is a bilabial consonant. Then we have labiodental as place of articulation. And an example for this is fish. So if you check what's used in producing, then the upper teeth are involved and the lower lip. Okay. Sometimes I mix things up, that's why I need to double check. Okay. The next one is dental, or sometimes called interdental. It's something that we don't have in German. Bath, okay, where the tip of the tongue is put between the teeth or at the lower end of the upper teeth. Yes. Okay. And we have alveolar. If we produce the word top, then of course the end is a bilabial plosive, is a bilabial consonant. But the first one, the T, is, well, I asked you at the beginning to put the tip of your tongue just behind the teeth to the alveolar ridge, and that's where the T is produced. We move further back in the mouth, and then we get to something that can be named in various different ways. You'll find this again and again in linguistics, that the same concept is named differently. Post-alveolar or palato-alveolar, or sometimes also alveopalatal. It's all the same thing, and that's the place in the mouth where if you put your tongue to, well, slightly further back, then you produce sh, as in ship. Yeah? It's slightly further back than the t. Then we've got palatal, as in yes, yi. Okay. Velar, as in k, as in kiss. And glottal, as in house. Okay. So basically, depending on where you put your tongue, you will produce a different consonant. And I think we saw this quite nicely in the videos. Manner of articulation. That was place. Now we have manner. And this relates to how, well, as it says here on the slide, how much obstruction is in the vocal tract. Whether the air can flow through without impediment, without being stopped, or whether there is something that stops or at least restricts the airflow in some way. This is also sometimes referred to as stricture. And we can distinguish between different types of stricture. Complete stricture, or sometimes called full blockage, where the air is, at least for a short moment, completely stopped. Partial stricture, sometimes referred to as close approximation. And if there is no stricture, then we have open approximation. So the air can pretty freely flow through the mouth. So it's pretty free, but as in pop, then the first and the last consonant, well, the two consonants, we have complete stricture, at least for a short period of time. And that's, in fact, what we call plosives. It's easy to remember. You can just think about an explosion, right? Because that's basically, to a certain extent, what it is. Right? And in fact, you can almost feel this. And this is again, okay, embarrassing thing to do. Number five, put your hand in front of your mouth and say something like pop. Pop. Yeah? Then you can actually, well, it's not really an explosion, of course, but you can feel that there is a burst of air that's coming out of your mouth. They're also called stops. And we can distinguish between bilabial plosives, alveolar plosives, velar plosives, and glottal plosives. And what I put between square brackets behind is in fact the IPA symbol that I think you've already been introduced to. Stops. So these are plosives. The next type is affricates. These are also sounds with complete stricture, and which means that the airstream is at some stage completely stopped. And in that sense, they are similar to plosives. But the release is different. So there is a difference between pop and pff, pff, or something like that. Yeah? Or ch, as in church. And you can try this out again. Ch, church. Church is different from pop. And we have judge, which is a voiced version of it. Notice that I think there is an error in the textbook, in the English language textbook, because I think in the overview, these are referred to as fricatives. Yeah. They're affricates. It's correct in the text, but there is an error in the table, if I remember correctly. Okay. Fricatives, in fact, is something similar, similar in the sense that we also have partial stricture, but we never have complete blockage to start with. So the in leave, it's not, but it's, and therefore labiodental, dental fricative, alveolar fricative, post-alveolar fricative, and glottal fricative. So the is not complete open, there is some friction. And the next one is approximants. These are the ones with open approximation, or where there is no stricture. So, articulator is a term that I also haven't introduced, if I remember correctly. These are basically the elements involved in producing sounds. The space between them is very wide, and that's why they are called approximants. So we have the R, well, the R in red, which is an alveolar approximant, and the Y as in yes, and the labial velar W. Why is this labial velar? Because really it's just the two lips, isn't it? W, W. But in fact, if you look at it, then the tongue also is involved in getting closer to the velum. So the back of the tongue moves up at the same time as the lips are rounded. And lateral approximants is also something, it's a bit of a special thing, but loud is basically, it's got to do with the shape of the tongue as well. This is, and we've got a glottal fricative, as in house. And why is the glottal fricative there? Because we're talking about approximants. I think I need to double check that. I think that's simply a mistake. Okay, sorry about that. Right, the last one, the last category I want to mention is nasals. They're made with complete, as it says here, oral closure. Air moves through our nose, and that's because the velum is lowered, makes sense. So, as in mat, we have the same setup as with plosives, with bilabial plosives, but the difference is that the mouth is never open, therefore there is no release, and the air just basically goes through the nose. We might also have, or we also have, alveolar nasals, as in hmm, and velar, as in sing. Hmm. Okay? These are the basic ones. There are also taps. Okay. For example, in American English, you wouldn't say city, but you would say city. City. Right? I'm not very good at that because I don't have an American accent, I think, mostly. But city, city. Or muddy. Yeah. It's basically just a tap, which is different from a real plosive. And we can also talk about trills. These are sort of rolled R's, which are available to some speakers of English. Right. In fact, we've only covered some of the sounds that are possible. There is a lot more out there. The IPA chart lists them all. The IPA chart is supposed to cover all the sounds of all the languages of the world. And this is the part that relates to consonants. And the IPA chart is organized as follows. We've got manner of articulation here, place of articulation on the horizontal, and then on the left we've got the voiceless consonants, and on the right we've got the voiced consonants. Once you've understood this, it's really quite easy to see what the symbol is for whatever consonant you're producing. So we can, for example, find a bilabial voiced nasal, which is hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. There is a copy of the IPA chart on StudIP. Some people, and this is now a joke alert, watch out, some people would like to extend the IPA with this sign, which, and if you understand the following, then you've understood place and manner, etc., of articulation, which they say is a nasal ingressive voiceless velar trill. Anyone? No? Choke, yeah.
Wouldn't that be the sound you make when you snore?
When you snore? Well, is it ingressive?
I think so.
Is it? Yeah, well, actually, you're right. Yes, true, yes. But not quite, almost. Because what about velar? Yes?
A pig sound,
yes, thank you. Right? And yeah, there are in fact t-shirts being sold. Okay? We'll perform nasal ingressive voices velar trills for food. I'm a trained linguist, don't try this at home. Some people find that funny. But it basically makes the point that there are symbols that can be related to particular types of articulation, namely manner and place, and whether it's voiced or not. Okay. Don't learn this. Okay, that's why I put joke alert up there. Right, let's move on to vowels. We need different types of concepts to describe this. All vowels are voiced. Okay. All vowels are produced with open approximation. Okay. And what we refer to instead is the vowel space. So the degree of stricture is useless for vowels because it's open anyway. You can try this out by producing the vowels, or you can try this. You can try out what's at issue by producing the vowels found in seat, set, and at, and sat. So e, e, a, e, e, a, e, e, a. You're welcome to do this. E, e, a. And you can see that the position of your tongue changes. You can do the same thing for the vowels in seat and soup. E-u, e-u. And then you can notice that it's not just the tongue that's involved, but something else. Because if you try to do the same thing without moving your lips, e-u, e-u, it doesn't really work. So generally speaking, it's the position of the tongue, but whether lips are rounded or not also plays a role. Now, this is typically shown in what's known as the vowel trapezium. And basically, it's a schematic representation of the inside of our mouth, which looks like this. And we have the front, the central and back elements of your mouth, and we have a situation where your mouth is closed or open, or closed mid or open mid. And we can use this area to describe the position of our tongue in order to locate with a particular symbol then where the vowel is produced. Tongue is either vertical, well, the position is relevant, but also the horizontal position, and in fact whether it moves or not. And as I said before, lips, whether they're rounded or not, play a role as well, whether they're spread or not. Unrounded. Can you produce an exaggerated smile when you say sheep? Yes, no problem. Can you do the same with soup? No, right? Doesn't work. Yeah, that's because one is rounded, the other one isn't. Yeah. In addition, we also have a distinction between short and long vowels. Now, this looks quite complicated. But these are basically the different vowels that are available in English, in British English, and in fact two different regional versions of British English. So we have, for example, a high, or some people call it, as I said, closed, front vowel, which is E, fleece. All of the vowels have a sort of particular name. This is the fleece vowel. And we've got the nurse vowel and the soup vowel. Mm-hmm. And if you produce these individual sounds yourself at home, can't go through all of them now, you will see how elements inside your mouth move. Okay. There are one or two things that I would like to say about this chart. You may be a little bit confused about the high mid vowels in words like face and goat, because what it actually says here is that they are face and goat, which is the case in the north of England. They are not pronounced, these words are not pronounced face, with a diphthong, as we'll call it, okay, but with a monophthong, with a single vowel, so it's face and goat. These vowels are not otherwise available. And there's also a distinction between the traditional RP version of cat, cat, and the normal everyday use of cat, ket versus cat. In fact, the ket of RP is fairly close to the sound that we produce when we say egg. The tongue so far hasn't moved in the production of these vowels, but of course, as I just said, with words like face or goat, they do. These vowels involve movement of the tongue, and the distinction is that between monophthong and diphthongs. These are the diphthongs available in British English. And in fact, what we have here is one vowel but two IPA symbols. Now, in this order, in the order that it's shown, it's price, face, I'll just give you a sample word. Price, face, choice, mouth, goat, near, square, poor. Poor. Now, this is British English. It'll be slightly different than American English. And then there's the most frequent vowel. And that's the vowel in about, and letter, right? That's when you're lazy, or not really lazy, but when it's unstressed. And this is known as the vowel schwa, which can also be described as a short, mid-central, unrounded vowel, because it's sort of in the middle of everything when nothing moves, or nothing needs to be moved in order to produce it. Right? It's a very, very frequent vowel in English, which is found in virtually all unstressed syllables. Now, this was a quick introduction into all of the basic sounds that we use in English and the symbols that we use for them. Other textbooks might, in fact, use different symbols. For example, you will find instead of I, you might find the second one, sort of with a J letter, particularly in American textbooks. It's a different notation. You need to be flexible. Okay. But the book that we're using uses IPA. Yeah. The nurse vowel, the nurse, yeah, is sometimes actually transcribed as a schwa in IPA. Yeah. Also, American pronunciation will require some different symbols as well. Right, I think you need about a minute or two break, but can you, during this break, do some work and transcribe the word phonetic? Phonetic. And try to give a detailed description of each of the sounds. Phonetic. Okay. Let's see whether you got what I suggest. I suspect you haven't done the full description of each vowel and each consonant yet, but let's look anyway. This is what I suggest. Phonetic. There are also ways to indicate stress, etc., but we don't need to do this at the moment. Phonetic. And what are the individual sounds? How are they produced? Place of articulation and things like that? Well, we have a voiceless labiodental fricative, a short mid-centered unrounded vowel, the schwa, phonetic, the voiced alveolar nasal, the short low mid front unrounded phonetic, the voiceless alveolar plosive, the short front unrounded e phonetic, and the voiceless velar plosive. I can guarantee there will be an exam question that will require you to do something like this. Okay? It's been the case for the past 4 years, it will be the case for the next 4 years. Okay? Not necessarily with a full word, not necessarily 7 or 8 letters or something like that, but you will need to be able to describe at least 1, possibly 2 vowels or consonants. And I can tell you that this is a really easy way to get some points if you learn it. A lot of people have not in the past. Okay? And there isn't really any excuse for this, because this is easily learnable. Yes, it is learning things by heart, but once you know the system and where and how things are produced, it's really quite easy. So, don't lose points. Practice a little. You will need to do this. You need to be able to do this. A bit of advice for transcribing if you want to do more than just one word, or in general. The point that I've made before is that spelling is not the same as pronunciation, which is why spelling is not a good guide for transcription. Often, the fact that we have 2 letters, digraphs, okay, in English, doesn't necessarily mean that there are 2 sounds. One thing that very often happens is that people confuse s and z. This is the only difference is whether it's voiced or not, and has nothing to do necessarily with the way the word is spelt. Notice that I've always put brackets around as well. Don't forget those brackets, but we only really, if you transcribe a whole word, need 1 set of brackets. So you don't need to put a bracket around each word. And there's no punctuation whatsoever. In fact, there is also no, because there's no symbol for upper and lower case. There's no upper and lower case, because this is just symbols that indicate different sounds. If you want to use a computer to do this, then you may need to may need to add something to your computer, depending on what operating system you use. You might need to install a font, etc. There is a piece of, there's a document that Kevin Watson, who is a former colleague of mine in Lancaster, put together for his students. It's no longer available on the web, but I have uploaded it on StudIP. It says, if you need any help, contact me. Don't contact him. And in fact, the email address given is in fact no longer valid. He's now in New Zealand. But I thought it was still useful for you. It may be slightly outdated depending on which operating system you're using, but the general principle might be the same. Yeah. He's also referring to some hex codes. If that doesn't make sense now, don't worry, just look at what Kevin Watson writes. They're available there. There's also a really nifty tool available at this address, which is the IPA chart. But if you click on an individual symbol, then it'll put it somewhere down at the bottom, and you can then copy-paste it into your Word document or whatever you're using. Another useful thing is the interactive vocal tract chart that is provided at this address. And that sort of visualizes what's happening when sounds are produced in different parts of your mouth. So for example, you can see the difference between this sort of rest position and a fricative, this is an alveolar fricative, this has just gone down. If I just go back, right, and notice it's voiced. It's quite easy to use for learning purposes as well. Okay, so you can see the connection between the terms and the positions that change in the mouth. Yeah. There are lots of sounds that I haven't covered, as I said. There are also lots of sounds of different dialects of English that I haven't covered. I've only done the basics. There are some really exotic sounds in English. Has anyone ever been exposed to someone from Liverpool or listened to an interview of a Liverpoolian football player? The dialect is Scouse. Okay. And in fact, there are some sounds in that dialect that don't typically exist in sort of standard or in RP. The K, for example, the K sound becomes fricative, as in shach, rather than shark, shark, or rather than saying weak, it's weich. It depends on the previous vowel, but notice that it's ch and sh. The Swiss can do this very well as well. Yeah, that's the difference. I'd like to play this to you. Here's Jamie Carragher.
Yeah, I don't know. As I got older, I'm a little bit awkward. I think I got slower. I went pretty quick because you know, you haven't managed to get back to the field for a few games there. I think Ronnie Brown had an idea that could maybe do a job at centre back.
Yeah? All right. I'll play that to you again. He says quicker, but he doesn't say quicker, he says quicker, quicker. And the last word he says is back, which is not back, but back. So I'll just play that again.
Yeah, I don't know. As I got older, people got quick. I think I got slower. I was pretty quick as a young lad in there. I managed to move back to midfield for a few games there. I think Ronnie Brown had an idea that maybe do a job at centre back.
Right? I understand about 10% of that when I hear it, so it's not only you. But it's not too far away from where I used to live, but it's a very, very distinctive accent. And Kevin Watson is a speaker of Scouts. Right. The last 20 minutes, I will try to introduce the difference between phonetics and phonology. What I'm going to say for the next 20 minutes is probably... No, I'm not saying I'm going to confuse you, but for some reason, this is one of the really, really, really difficult things to grasp. Once you've got it, it's dead easy. But for some reason, maybe something like 40, 50% of students don't get it in the first time. Okay? That's why I'm doing it twice. That reduces the number of people who don't get it at all. I hope you will. I hope I can make myself clear. I've asked also the people running the tutorials, how can I get this across in a better way? And they couldn't help me either. Let's see. So this is important. If you don't get this, come back next week. If you still don't get it, you need to get it. Yeah? Because it is one of the major differences that we will meet again in later stages of the lecture when we talk about morphology, for example. Is there a difference between the two consonants, which are the same consonants, in those two words, pit versus spit? Is it the same letter? Yes, but we've already said that letters now. Are these the same voiceless bilabial plosives? Well, you can find out by putting your hand in front of your mouth again. Produce those two words and see whether there is a difference. What's the difference? Whether you say pit or spit. Yeah, the second one, spit, is weaker in what sense? I mean, what is weaker? The amount of air, maybe not. Well, the speed or the pressure with which the air hits your hand, right? Okay. Why is that? Well, because this has got to do with aspiration. Has much more aspiration than spit. Yeah. Okay. So, yes, they are the same, but they're different. Both are bilabial plosives. Both are voiceless. But there is a small difference. The first one is aspirated. I've put a little H there behind the P. And the other one isn't. Can you find any word in the English language where the difference between p and p, well, it's difficult to do this without, yeah, between the aspirated one and the non-aspirated one creates a change in meaning? Yeah? But that doesn't have a bilabial plosive. Yeah, but I'm referring specifically to the difference between the same consonant in, for example, the words pit and spit, which are bilabial plosives. So we need to restrict it to this. I'm not saying that there isn't a difference between aspect of what you've said, but it doesn't involve bilabial plosives. Can you find one? Well, you can think about it for a long time. The answer is no. There is no word in English. There might be in Korean, Vietnamese, or whatever, I don't know. But not in English, where the difference between an aspirated P and a non-aspirated one creates a different word or creates a meaning difference. Can you find two words where the only thing that's different is B or V? That's easy. Bet versus vet. This is a so-called minimal pair, because the only thing that changes is one vowel. Are these different consonants? Yes. Are these different consonants? Yes, in terms of aspiration, but they're the same in many other ways. Well, they're the same in the sense that they do not create a meaning distinguishing effect in the English language. So, P, the aspirated and the non-aspirated P, fulfill the same function. B and V do not fulfill the same function. Do we have any speakers of Spanish here? Any native speakers of Spanish? Okay. Is that the same in Spanish?
No.
Yeah, the B and the V are pronounced the same way. Well, no, they're not pronounced the same way. Because you're still saying B or V, but that distinction does not make a difference for what word you produce. Yes, but if I were to say basso or vaso, you would understand the same word. Yeah? If I say bet or vet, you will not understand the understand the same word. So I agree with you. There are ways of pronouncing consistent ways of pronouncing a word in Spanish, but you are using what in fact in English are two consonants in the system of English. You are using the same sounds and do not produce a meaning distinguishing effect. Yeah? So my favorite sentence is the one, well, not my favorite, but if a Spanish person says, I have problems with my vowels, that might come out as I have problems with my bowels, which is something quite different. And the Spanish-speaking person will simply not feel that there is a difference. Will then be very worried about the fact that the other person wonders, why does she tell me that she's got problems with her bowels? It just doesn't sound any different to the Spanish brain, because the Spanish brain is not accustomed to making a distinction between B and V. While we have absolutely no problems in German or in English to make that distinction. So there is no minimal pair that can be produced with B and V in Spanish, which means that they form elements, or they are part of the same phoneme. So the phoneme is... I'll just go on. Okay. We have sounds. In fact, most of the lecture was about the different sounds that we produce in English. They can be called phones. They are language independent. The sound B is the same in Spanish as it is in French and Korean and Russian and Japanese and what have you. Whether it does the same thing within those languages is a different thing. So, different phones, as we've just seen with the Spanish example, can be used for the same function in a particular language. And that's what we call a phoneme. And that's, therefore, language dependent. So, the aspirated P and the non-aspirated P are simply realizations of the same phoneme. They're different. But it doesn't matter in the system of English. And we can distinguish between a phonetic transcription, which is basically what we've seen so far, where we describe or transcribe phones, and we put them between square brackets. We also have a phonemic transcription, where we have phonemes, which we then put between slashes. So, in other words, if we want to have a phonetic transcription of spit and pit, then to draw attention to the fact that in fact the two plosives are slightly different, we can indicate this with the aspiration symbol H. But if we want to transcribe these words phonemically, then we do not need to indicate this difference because they're the same. Yeah? So the difference is only at the phonetic level, but not at the phonemic level in English. I'm sure you find a language where there is a difference between aspirated p and non-aspirated p, but not English. To show this or to refer to this, we use the term allophone. So in other words, the aspirated p and the non-aspirated p are both different phones, but they are allophones of the same phoneme in the English system. B and V are both sounds, are both allophones in Spanish of the Spanish phoneme V or B, or whatever you choose, it doesn't matter. Okay. Have I convinced 50% already? Bottle. How do you say bottle? Well, it depends. There are two ways of pronouncing it. What it? Well, the plosive that's involved. You can either say bottle, or you can say bottle. Bottle. Right? With a glottal stop. In fact, my son who grew up in the north of England, he used to say, water bottle. Where's my water bottle? Huh? Not 100% of all linguists agree on this, and I'll say next time why. But you could also say that these different realizations, t, and the glottal stop, which I can't produce because it's a stop in the glottis, as in bottle, are allophones of the phoneme t in English. Right. Difficult? It's dead easy once you've understood it. Yeah? But I do agree it's an abstract way of thinking about it. The interesting thing is that we will see the same difference between something that doesn't and something that does end in im at different layers of the description of English or of language. We will be talking about morphs and morphemes. We will also make a distinction between word forms and lexemes. And in this case, we make a distinction between phones and their and the counterpart would then be phoneme. Right. Next lecture, as I said, there will be more on phonology, and I will go over what I've just said again. You don't want to hear about what's happening next lecture? I will also say something about syllables and their structure, and we'll look at connected speech. What happens to when we produce sound in spontaneous conversation? And that will introduce a few additional aspects that are quite interesting, I think. See you next Friday.